This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of January 17th, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. Welcome to edition number 169. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, headlines from the Pacific Rim and the Pacific Northwest. The Is It Just Me commentary. I award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. And the big deal feature, British Columbia's vaccine rollout. You can call it Operation Slowpoke. A shakeup at the top and a bombshell from the main supplier of the coronavirus vaccine. I summarize last week's developments. And I speak to Todd Hopman, a kidney transplant recipient who is calling on the BC government to prioritize vaccinations for organ transplant recipients and people with compromised immune systems. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or will we see more of Premier John Horgan in 2021 than we did in 2020? Except for the snap election campaign last fall, when Horgan was in front of reporters almost daily, the affable NDP premier took a back seat to Dr. Bonnie Henry and Health Minister Adrian Dix. On January 14th, Horgan returned to the public eye after almost a month to make his first media appearance of the new year. He was one of the last major political leaders in Canada or the US to make a first appearance of the new year. Horgan did not earn himself any praise. He made this paternalistic comment when asked about a call by the opposition BC Liberals for more transparency in coronavirus pandemic data.
In terms of transparency and distribution of information to the public, we have done the best we can to make sure that those that need to know do know. But creating hysteria when there may not be a prospect of transmission is what we want to avoid.
Horgan had promised in the summer to make public a report by Peter Milburn, a former top bureaucrat, about the future of the Site C Dam. He even hinted during the election campaign that the NDP was taking a serious look again at cancelling the $10.7 billion project. Milburn is not an engineer. His report to cabinet, which has not been released yet, has sparked the NDP to hire two engineers, John France and Kerry Hogue, to conduct another report or two. Meanwhile, construction continues at a rate of $3 million a day. BC Hydro refuses to release a list of who is working on the project and how much they are paid. BC Hydro also has refused, for the first time, to release a copy of the Maine Civil Works Contractors' Monthly Progress Report. As I said after Horgan won that snap election with a four-year majority mandate, the NDP faces challenges like no other government. How Horgan handles the pandemic and BC's most expensive project will define his career as premier. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim.
In Apple Daily, China reports first COVID death in 8 months. China reported 138 new coronavirus cases on Wednesday, the biggest daily spike in more than 10 months and the first death since May last year, while Taiwan confirmed the first case of the highly transmissible South African variant in an Eswatini national. Of the 138 additional infections, 124 were locally transmitted and 14 were imported. Most of the cases came from Hebei province, which has been scrambling to contain a new outbreak this month. The province has recorded double-digit increases each day since January the 4th and up to 103 cases on January 10th. In the Japan Times, Japan bars entry for new arrivals and business travelers due to new COVID-19 strains. The government has warned that it may disclose the names of those who violate quarantine measures. Penalties for foreign nationals may be stricter. Foreigners who violate the rules may have their residence permits revoked and, as a result, may face deportation under Japan's immigration law. While remaining in self-isolation, the returnees are obliged to record information on their health condition using a contact tracing app named COCO, granting it access to location data on their smartphones. In the New Zealand Herald, COVID-19 traveler from South Africa tests positive on day 18 in New Zealand. The other cases come from all over the world, including the US, Malaysia, India, South Africa, Italy, United Kingdom, Russia, Bahrain, and the United Arab Emirates. Meanwhile, people from the Cook Islands will be allowed to come to New Zealand without going into quarantine from next week. It comes as tough new travel regulations come into force for Kiwis returning from global COVID hotspots as concerns mount over New Zealand's vulnerability to the most contagious strains to date. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast.
Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest.
In the Oregonian, Portland to lobby feds on reparations for Black Indigenous communities. Financial payments or other aid to the descendants of enslaved Black Americans and Native Americans harmed by the U.S. government was the top racial justice measure listed in Portland's annual federal policy agenda, which the City Council approved last week. Representative Sheila Jackson Lee, a Texas Democrat, reintroduced a bill that would create a commission to examine reparations for African American descendants of slavery, a proposal that has never been brought to a full House vote. In the Olympian, these Washington State Republicans voted to impeach President Donald Trump. Washington Representatives Jamie Herrera Buehler of Vancouver and Dan Newhouse of Yakima supported impeachment. They were among 10 Republicans who joined 222 Democrats in calling for the president's removal from office. In the Seattle Times, clinics, pop-ups, and churches, how Washington might double or triple COVID-19 vaccination rates. Washington State aims to reach 70% herd immunity among people 16 and older in about 7 months. The state is using about 15,000 to 20,000 doses of vaccine each day. Officials say it needs to put 45,000 doses in arms a day. The main hurdle is a consistent and reliable supply from the federal government. Washington has received almost 625,000 doses and used almost 202,000 doses as of January the 11th. And in Czech news, Coast Guard's new marine mammal desk reports sightings in real time to protect BC orcas. Fisheries and Oceans Canada says the desk in Sydney will be staffed 24 hours a day to advise area vessel traffic of orcas, humpbacks, and gray whales. It will use radar and take reports of sightings from Coast Guard vessels, light stations, and fisheries and oceans aircraft. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. This week, I take a look at Operation Slowpoke. That's the name I've given British Columbia's coronavirus vaccine program. As of January 15th, only 75,000 people in the province of 5.1 million people have received their first of two doses. A shakeup in British Columbia's vaccine rollout program after the province ran out of Pfizer doses. On December 9th, NDP Health Minister Adrian Dix named Dr. Ross Brown as the man in charge. Brown is the Vice President of Pandemic Response for Vancouver Coastal Health.
Dr. Ross Brown, who is the Incident Commander of the Immunize BC Operations Centre, he's in charge of our big rollout. So it's pretty exciting and positive to have him here today, and he and his team are doing great work.
It has been an honour to work alongside Dr. Henry and Minister Dix. I thank you. And it is an absolute privilege to serve as the Incident Commander for what we are calling our Immunize BC Operations Center. It's made up of the team of respected experts to safely and effectively deliver the COVID-19 vaccines to British Columbians.
On January 13th, a hastily called news conference involving Dix and Dr. Bonnie Henry to name Penny Ballum, the chair of Vancouver Coastal Health, as the new head of the program. Brown was demoted. He was not involved in the announcement, and officials did not explain the reason for the change. So we are left to read between the lines.
I'm pleased to announce that Dr. Penny Ballum has agreed to be the BC Immunization Executive Lead for the province for this next phase of our vaccination efforts. Dr. Ross Brown will continue in his leadership role on logistics, and additional members will be added to the team under Dr. Ballum's leadership over the coming weeks. I want to personally recognize the continuing work of Dr. Ross Brown.
Ballum was Deputy Health Minister under Premier Gordon Campbell and later the City Manager of Vancouver under Mayor Gregor Robertson. Ballum was a board member of Vancouver's 2010 Winter Olympics Organizing Committee and later signed the contract that kept the Olympics archive secret until 2025.
I feel very, very privileged to have been asked to do this. It's obviously, as the Minister said, one of the most important initiatives know we've ever been tasked with in our health sector in BC. We've made terrific progress, but as the minister indicated, the scale of, you know, the timeline of moving to vaccinate our population who are eligible for the vaccine by the end of September, as committed by the federal government, the Prime Minister, that is our goal, and it is it's a mammoth task. It can be done.
2 days later, federal Liberal Procurement Minister Anita Anand's bombshell, a temporary delay in shipments of Pfizer vaccine while a factory in Belgium is expanded.
I was informed that due to work to expand its European manufacturing capacity, production of the Pfizer-BioNTech COVID-19 vaccine will be impacted for a short period. This expansion work means that Pfizer is temporarily reducing deliveries to all countries receiving vaccine manufactured at its European facility, and that includes Canada. Before discussing this further, I wish to be very clear from the outset. This is a temporary delay, and we remain on track to have enough approved vaccines for everyone who wishes to be vaccinated by the end of September 2021.
In BC, Dix was vague about how few doses will arrive later this month.
The following week, the week of January 25th, we're seeing the biggest change across the country. And in BC, we expect a handful of trays of Pfizer that week, and that's down from what we expected, which would have been 29,000 in that week.
BC's average since mid-December is more than 2,000 jabs per day. By the end of March, it's forecast that fewer than 250,000 people will have received both doses in BC. Officials say they want to reach herd immunity by the end of September. That would be about 70% of the province's population. To do that, there needs to be a massive turnaround. There needs to be around 28,000 shots per day, according to my calculations. That's about how many people could fit into BC Play Stadium's lower bowl. The faster BC is vaccinated, the faster the disease is defeated, and the faster the economy recovers, and the faster my next guest, Todd Hopman, can breathe a sigh of relief. Todd is a senior communications professional in BC higher education. He has also worked on political campaigns for the BC Liberals and, more recently, the NDP. Todd Hopman is also a board member of the Transplant Research Foundation of BC. In 2010, he underwent a kidney transplant. And people with transplants, like Todd, are concerned when they will get on the pecking order to get the all-important coronavirus vaccine. Explain how that ties into the challenges that you're facing during the pandemic.
So, you know, with the second lease on life, in my case, I'm very healthy and my kidney function is very stable. And fortunately, I've had the opportunity to continue to lead my life to the fullest extent that I can. And day in, day out, what it looks like for me is taking medication twice a day, being very mindful of my diet, exercise, often much the same advice to anyone, but twice daily medication continues. And one thing that many folks don't know is that organ transplants are not cures, that they are considered treatments. And fortunately, myself and many of my transplant friends, our organs last a very long time, and we're very fortunate for that, but it is not a cure. And so for me, through this pandemic, of course, my life has been very different, as all of ours has been very different. But for me, I'm a lot more, been a lot more careful, a lot more diligent, and it matters. You know, when people decided not to have Halloween parties or not to gather at Christmas, that positively benefits risk groups like myself, not just seniors, but those of us who've had transplants, people who live with autoimmune diseases. So many of us throughout this province who are in these risk groups have lived very diligent lives throughout this pandemic. And for me, what that means is that the space I'm in, my apartment, is where I spend the vast majority of my time now with my partner. And other than walks and groceries, a very select number of activities, I spend most of my time at home. And I take what Dr. Henry says in terms of precautions very, very seriously, because I know the impact of this virus and what it could do to my body if I did get it. So we're very careful, and we're also very careful because we want to also protect other people. So, you know, in terms of ongoing vaccine processes and rollout, for me, the number one piece of information I think that Dr. Henry and Adrian Dix need to know is that it's for us, we are hoping that the, and I'm speaking for myself, you know, I hope that transplant patients are a priority. I hope that after all of the investment through the healthcare system that the BC government has put into patients like myself, that there is a priority on us. And, you know, the challenging thing that I'm well aware of is that the data for immunocompromised patients, including in particular transplant patients, is relatively limited. I'm excited to hear as of this week that there's a massive ongoing study in the United States with transplant patients receiving the vaccine. So that study will hopefully provide the data that Dr. Henry and Adrian Dix and other public health officials need to make that call. And so it's a very nerve-wracking time. In some ways, Bob, I would say that this period of waiting is much similar to how I felt in the final months before I had my transplant, where, you know, I saw that that light at the end of the tunnel, but I wasn't quite there yet. And obviously it's filled with nerves, filled with emotion and anticipation.
Talk about that emotional roller coaster. At the same time, as you do still, we all still see various news headlines, sometimes even see it with our own eyes in the community of people that are not taking things seriously. What do you do to try to, I guess, keep your frustration down when you see those stories or see that with your own eyes?
Well, I think one thing I've learned potentially the hard way is that remembering that I can only control what I do. And ultimately, you know, I'm going to take all those precautions and do everything I can and encourage those in my immediate network to follow suit as well and emphasize to them that this is important, not just for you, but also for British Columbians like me that are in a high risk group. And so when I see people who aren't wearing masks, or I see the rallies at the art gallery, it's incredibly frustrating, infuriating. But you know, ultimately, again, I can only control my behavior and my own sphere of influence. And I try and stay focused on that, because, you know, when I see these news stories about some of these so-called freedom rallies, I want to go get a megaphone and emphasize that their actions, they may believe what they believe, but their actions have consequence on their grandma, on their friend who they may or may not know, who might be someone like me who's in their 30s, who has some kind of medical condition that puts them in a place of risk with COVID-19. So, but ultimately too, I have to have faith that that many, many people in BC are doing everything they can to protect all of us.
What kind of activities are you undertaking to lobby the government to make sure that the politicians and the people in power who make these big decisions know what the issues are and know what they need to do for people in the transplant community? Because the transplant community is very important. There are campaigns every year that remind people to sign up as an organ donor should they die, that someone else can have that second lease on life.
I'm certainly not speaking on behalf of the Transplant Research Foundation, but what I can say is for me personally, you know, I'm talking to patient organizations, including the Kidney Foundation. I'm talking to as many folks as I can, and trying to educate both myself and educate others. I also, you know, as much as I can, I'm trying to have those important conversations with patient organizations. And I think the role that that we play is to highlight the priority nature of patients like myself. You know, I think many patient organizations and myself personally realize that data is important for Dr. Henry to make these decisions and public health officials to make these decisions. But in the meantime, you know, one thing that I do believe is very important that can be done for patients like myself, and I've heard chatter about this point, and that is having caregivers and spouses of immunocompromised patients in our province, having those people vaccinated, because by vaccinating them, then we protect the patient themselves, patients like myself. And so I think for me, my ongoing effort as well is including trying to reach out to the National Immunization Advisory Committee, and that committee has one member who has a connection to the transplant community. So this particular person is a nurse in Alberta Health who works with transplant patients, and this particular person is the only one on that committee that has any connection to the transplant community. So I'm making efforts to reach out to her, making efforts to reach out to MLAs. You know, I've talked to my own medical team, but I think the number one piece of advocacy, and I think this is the case with any patient advocacy, is emphasizing and advocating for ourselves. And so, you know, hopefully if there are other transplant patients or those who are connected to transplant patients listening to this podcast, you know, contact your MLAs, get educated, contact this committee nationally, because I understand that this committee is driving a lot of the direction of vaccine rollout across the country. Suzanne Smith is this committee member. And so I think as much as I can do advocacy, I'm hoping that many patients like myself within the transplant community and those with all sorts of autoimmune diseases and anyone that is in an immunocompromised position, I'd encourage them to contact this committee, contact MLAs, so that we can have some movement on these items.
In your case, where will you go? What will you do once you have that vaccine in you, that assurance that you're out of the woods, out of danger? What are you keeping in top of your mind to keep your hope alive? What are you going to do?
Beyond actually maybe having dinner with a couple of friends and family. Remember when we used to go for dinner or have meals with other people besides our household? I think that's top of the list, and not far behind that is traveling. My partner and I love to travel, and we traveled the last handful of years. And I think for me, top of mind is as soon as it's safe to travel, I want to travel, likely to Europe. I'm also, I think, looking forward to, you know, I think it's fair to say for all of us right now, there's a degree of worry, anxiety, fear. You know, there's a lot of unknowns, and I think probably besides those two things, I think top of mind for me is just not having to deal with, you know, with the pandemic and the nervousness that comes with the pandemic, and just the freedom kind of sigh of relief, much the same, the sigh of relief I will have on January 20th. And so, you know, I think for me, it's also, you know, many of us haven't been able to not only see family members, but, you know, even just hug family members. I know that seems so simple. But I think that's also, for me, top of mind.
That was my guest, Todd Hopman, You can find out more about organ transplants. Go to trfbc.org. To learn about the BC Organ Donor Registry and even sign up, go to transplant.bc.ca.
Nanaimo Bar, brought to you by Spruce Hill Contracting.
Every week we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo Bar to a person or group that is making a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to Vancouver Canucks goaltender Braden Holtby for hiring Coast Salish artist Luke Marston to redesign his mask, the one that caused a kerfuffle in December after a bad take by a Swedish artist. So congratulations, Braden Holtby and Luke Marston. Nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send us an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Spruce Hill Contracting, custom homes and renovations. Find more information at sprucehill.ca. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of January 17th, 2021. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on January 17th in 1961, President Dwight Eisenhower warned in his televised farewell speech of the military-industrial complex?
In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. We must never let the weight of this combination endanger our liberties or democratic processes.
And in 1998, Matt Drudge broke the story of the Bill Clinton-Monica Lewinsky affair on the Drudge Report. Now you know. Send me your feedback. Send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit TheBreaker.News on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/TheBreakerNews. That's P-A-T-R-E-O-N.com/TheBreakerNews. Until next week.